We'll search for Venus in the museums of Europe in just a bit. Before the coronavirus upended everything, tourism statistics showed that Spain was second only to France in the number of foreign visitors it attracts each year. The World Economic Forum even ranked Spain as the best-equipped country in the world for handling its tourism popularity. I think Spain's worth visiting more than once, thanks to the variety of its regional differences. What we often think of as the essence of Spain is what you'll find bursting out all over in Andalusia. That's thanks to the influences of its historic Moorish heritage and its famously sunny climate. Right now, we're joined by three tour guides from Spain to explore what makes Andalusia so special. Jorge Roman lives in Madrid. Francisco Glaria comes from Pamplona, and Robert Wright now makes his home in Sevilla. It's nice to have all of you sharing your insights into Spanish culture. Just before we get started, what are the sort of clichetic icons of Andalusia? Just give me the word. What do we think?
Flamenco.
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 Flamenco
would be one thing, yeah. Also the land of the conquistadores, where they departed to the New World in the past.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sevilla was a departure point for a lot of the great explorers going to, Columbus got his marching orders, I think, in Sevilla.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
You've got Jerez, is that?
Jerez, the sherry wine.
Sherry. Yeah. Yeah. Olive oil. Yeah. The Alhambra.
And the horses of
horses, yeah.
Beautiful Spanish stallions.
And land of the toros.
Now, Jorge, as a madrileño, is that what a Madrid person is called?
Madrileño.
Madrileño. When you think of Andalusia, you're from Castile, right, in the center of Spain.
Basically. I live in Madrid, yeah.
But you're from Andalusia. Your family was there.
Yeah.
What do people in the big city look at the people of Andalusia? What do they see?
They see a place where they can go on holidays, of course, but also lately they have that kind of chance of gastronomy issues going down there. People are getting
gastronomy.
They're getting very foodie in the sense of Andalusian gastronomy, especially inland. You know, when you go to the Mediterranean part or the Atlantic part of Andalusia, it's like a touristic resort anywhere you go.
But okay, now, that's the Costa del Sol.
That's the Costa del Sol, yeah.
So I would say, and I'll just be bold, the Costa del Sol is one long paved tourist trap.
It is, absolutely, you know? I agree.
I mean, there's you can find some charm there, but the interior is
the
more
interior.
Cultural.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So how would the cuisine be distinct in Andalusia from the rest of Spain?
Everything's more natural. I mean, when you're big cities, you just go and everything is almost processed. Yeah. There, in little towns, it's very normal to find a family that they have their own farm and they're using their fresh products at the season. You don't get tomatoes from a hot house. When you eat a salad there and you eat the tomatoes and you eat the veggies in there, they're like going back to your childhood.
So you're eating local, you're eating with local. The season.
Correct,
and you've got that wonderful explosion.
And with three, four ingredients, you can make an amazing stew.
What's your favorite meal if you go to Andalusia?
Oh, my goodness, gazpacho is one of them, but only in season, only in summer.
There's another cold vegetable drink.
Salmorejo. It's a little bit thicker. Mm-hmm.
Do you find that mostly in the summer because it's for the hot time?
That's right. It's a cold soup. Yeah. And the ingredients is just bread, garlic, olive oil, and some tomato. That's it. Four ingredients. Amazing.
That is a good example of that simplicity, but that quality.
That's right.
Francisco, from the north of Spain, when you think of Andalusia, what do you think?
I think about flamenco.
You do?
Yeah. Andalusia has something that's called duende. It's something magical. It's something that it's in the air and you feel it. And in the flamenco, it's like a concentrated version of that power of Andalusia.
Now, is that kind of related to you're in the north, so you would be more...
Celtic.
Celtic, yeah. More predictable, more cerebral, less emotional. Is there any of that?
Okay, yes.
You personally.
In the south, though, you've got throw your arms up in the air. And
the thing is that Andalusia, it was culturally dominated by the Muslims.
Right.
When we think Muslims, we tend to think about, you know, Al-Qaeda and all of these things. No, the Muslims was the most advanced culture at that time. Very open people, a lot of greatness. And up there in the north, we did not have that. So we don't have that refinement, that pleasure of beauty, the pleasure of beautiful things. I mean, when you go to see the Alhambra, it's just the pleasure of perfection. I mean, you're going to be smelling flowers. You're going to be just listening to water, guitar music. So all of that magic is the Andalusian magic. It's what we call duende.
You just took me to Cordoba.
Perfect place.
And Cordoba is the great Muslim heritage survives there in the south of Spain. A lot of people, when they think of the Muslim hordes, you know, I mean, Europe was threatened by the Muslims from Vienna and then coming across Gibraltar. And we forget that, you know, when Europe was pretty much in the Dark Ages, the light was coming from
there.
Islam. mm-hmm. and it came into Spain, and today you feel that sophistication.
Yeah.
Robert Wright, you've lived all over the place. You've got a passion for the Spanish and Portuguese languages, and you've settled in Sevilla, in Andalusia. Why did you choose Andalusia?
The easy reason is that my husband is from there, so there you go. He's Sevillano,
okay,
and I decided to get married, and it was a perfect...
And that's his place.
That's his place. But other than that, just to picture a perfect city in Spain, a city that has, like, everything you need from a big city, but has a small-town vibe to it. And also, prices are very affordable. It's not like Madrid or Barcelona, where the concentration of the population and lots of people and drives prices up, and it's big and busy. Sevilla is... like the biggest small town you'll ever find, I think, in Europe. It's great.
You know,
it's
really
fantastic.
Is. And I was just walking across Sevilla a few months ago, and I came upon a square. And I was going from one museum to another gallery, and I just paused in the square, and the mothers were there with their children.
Everyone's
and
out.
The retired people were there, and there was a little playground, and there
Talk
was the
cafe.
Talk
to your neighbors. Take a stroll. The weather's always really nice, except in August. I mean, it does get a little hot.
A little hot. That's one thing I can't handle coming from Seattle is the heat in the summer of Sevilla.
We compensate with great winters. Winters are great, and also it's off-season.
And you're a gay couple.
Yeah, it's amazing. A lot of people think of Spain as a very Catholic country and a very conservative country,
right?
Which some of that is true, depending on where you're at. But in general, it's a very open place. Spain was actually adopted gay marriage in 2005. And it was the third country in the world, I believe, to even...
Okay.
Just to give you a good example, is my husband and I, we walk hand in hand down the streets in Sevilla and nobody even looks twice.
We're getting to know the Andalusia region of Spain on Travel with Rick Steves with tour guides Robert Wright, Francisco Glaria, and Jorge Roman. From my experience, the region's capital city, Seville, is a must-see for visitors. But you can't forget Granada and Cordoba. Jorge, how would you describe what distinguishes these three cities in the region for people who are planning a visit to Andalusia?
Sevilla, Flamenco, Granada, Alhambra, and Cordoba, the mosque, now cathedral.
The mosque, which has the big cathedral built
inside,
in the middle of it.
Correct.
Okay, so those are the big iconic experiences or sites. Francisco, if you think of those three towns and you have only a few days, which two would you visit?
You have to go yes or yes to Sevilla.
Sevilla, yeah.
And I would choose Granada. The vibe of the city I love, and I'm deeply in love with Alhambra.
The Alhambra. Why are you in love with the Alhambra?
It's so different. I'm from the north, so it's so different from what I'm used to. It's the light. It's the way the sun sets.
Yeah.
It's breathtaking.
One of my favorite moments is directly across up in the Albaicín, and there's the famous square where everybody hangs out and the sun goes down, and there's gypsy musicians, and they're playing there, and it's a concert. You just get a drink, sit down on a rock and watch them. You got the sun warming the rocks of the Alhambra. It glows, this beautiful color, and you go... Wow, what took me so long? I have arrived.
Yeah, the view of the Alhambra from the Albaicín, it's, to me, perfection.
Oh, man. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking the highlights of Andalusia. Our phone number is 877-333-7425. We have an email from Martina in Atlanta. And Martina writes, I feel so privileged to have spent 10 days in Andalusia recently. I hit the big three, Granada, Sevilla, and Cordoba. I wanted to see a real flamenco performance, so I went to one of the caves in Sacromonte in Granada. It was touristy, but really fun. I also saw a performance at the Flamenco Museum in Sevilla. That was very different, clearly more authentic. Can you speak about the differences? Which type of performance is the real deal? And is there such a thing? Robert.
There are definitely all kinds of flamenco performances in southern Spain. Because you have so much tourism, there's a lot of people who go, and of course, it's synonymous with Andalusia. So there are the more typical touristy places that often will try to ply you with drinks and basically charge you high admission fees and keep you there for a long time. And the shows are of questionable quality. There's a lot of them on the main drag that really they just busloads of tourists come in there.
You know, there are a lot that really have a mission of keeping the culture alive, the flamenco culture. And when you find one of them, they're touristic because it's the only way for them to be in business. But it really is genuine.
Those are great.
It's at an hour where you're not staying up past your bedtime.
Mm-hmm.
It's affordable and it's instructive.
And especially at the Flamenco Museum because they are an educational facility and
exactly.
They want to teach you what's going on with flamenco.
And that's the Flamenco Museum that Martina recommended here
exactly.
In Sevilla. And in some of them, you can pay a little extra and go to a flamenco class.
You can have a class.
All right. Jorge, we've been talking about the cities, but there's also the root of the Pueblos Blancos.
Yeah, that's right.
I love it. Tell us what the root of the Pueblos Blancos is.
The province of Malaga, the north of the province, is the beginning, let's say, of the that route of the Pueblos Blancos, and it goes from that area towards west in the inland. Uh-huh. Okay, and it goes one of these beautiful cities in the world, which is called Ronda.
And first of all, the root of the Pueblos Blancos means in English?
The route of the white villages.
So these are the whitewashed villages.
Correct.
These classic little hill-capping villages.
That's right.
And they're white because historically...
That comes from the Muslim domination that we had for almost 800 years, and there were many myths about it, that to keep away the bad spirits, and the other is that just to whitewash, because in winter it keeps the house warm inside and cool in the summer.
So natural insulation or heat.
Correct,
or something.
Correct, yeah. And they still use that in the north of Africa, and it's part of the culture of the south of Spain.
So you talked about Ronda. What are some experiences you might have if you go from Ronda into the villages of these mountains?
The roads are so winding and so scenic. They're beautiful. Suddenly you find a little lake here, and then just round one of the bends, a hill with a castle on the very top, and that beautiful white town surrounding the castle, and the blue sky, beautiful.
Are you thinking Sahara?
Sahara is one of those.
Beautiful.
Grazalema. Yeah.
And then nearby, of course, you have Jerez.
Of course.
You guys all talked about the icons of Andalusia. You got your horses and you got your sherry.
Correct. Jerez, J-E-R-E-Z, is the Christian name of Sherish, which is the Arabic old name of the city, Sherish.
There you go.
That's why they call it Sherry, because for an English-speaking person to say Jerez is really
too
complicated.
Difficult. Sherry.
So that's why they call it Sherry.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We've been talking with Jorge Roman, Robert Wright, and Francisco Gloria about the wonders of Andalusia. Let's finish just with a final thought. Francisco, if you wanted to be like a temporary local in Andalusia, what would you do?
I would go for the bulls. To me, the bull culture is something I really like. Either go to a bullfight, or if you think that could be a little bit too risque, go to a bull farm and learn from the bulls in the land.
You can actually, as a tourist, go to a bull farm.
There are many bull farms that can be visitable, and it's perfect.
All right. And Robert Wright, what would you do to feel the soul of Andalusia?
I think anyone who really wants to feel what it's like to be a local and feel the soul of Andalusia would be to come to Sevilla during Holy Week. It may be a little bit more expensive. It may be a little bit more crowded, but that's the point. You have to get into these festivals when you can. And honestly, when you stand there at the perfect corner waiting on the procession to come by, you hear it coming toward you. Mm. And then all of a sudden, the float turns around the corner and you see those beautiful candles lit up. You smell the incense. And then everybody gets perfectly quiet to give respect as the Virgin passes.
Oh, it's a beautiful thing.
And then you go on and you see the next one, and the next one, and the next one. It's a whole week of that.
That's beautiful. Jorge, what would be an experience that you wouldn't miss next time you go to Andalusia?
Definitely to go to the southwest of Andalusia and go to a little town called Aracena. It's the land of the Serrano ham. Jabugo is the place, and that is a delicacy. Sorry for anybody else that makes that kind of ham, but I have to be a defender of that. That is a real... I have to say, it's Rick, please allow me, gastronomical orgasm to have one of those chunks of ham in your hand and then just, oh my God, this is unique, you know, absolutely unique.
And it's one of the great experiences of Andalusia.
And of your life.
Francisco, Jorge, Robert, gracias.
Gracias.
Gracias, Rick. Thank
Time
you.
For ham.
Let's go.
Nos perdimos saludamos.
Any traveler who's visited Europe's art museums has probably noticed that they tend to be filled with one very popular subject, women. Here to talk with me about that is my friend and co-author, Gene Openshaw.
Hi, Rick.
Hey, Gene, there sure are a lot of famous paintings and statues featuring women.
Women standing, women seated, reclining on beds.
Queens, warriors, angels.
Goddesses, saints. These works of art capture the many different timeless aspects of women. They're what some scholars have dubbed Venuses. Here's one really famous example. You'll know it. Let me paint a picture for you. It's a beautiful spring day on the Mediterranean. Suddenly she appears. It's Venus, the goddess of love. She poses gracefully, her body gently curving.
Now I can see her Venus de Milo.
No, this one has arms. The maiden rises from the turquoise sea. She's borne aloft on a seashell. The wind blows. Her hair billows like a shampoo commercial.
Okay, now I got it. It's The Birth of Venus by Botticelli.
Exactly. Or as many tourists call her,
Venus on a half shell. So Botticelli's Venus, that's just one of many Venuses in the long history of art. In fact, it stretches way back to the very first objects ever created by the human species. We're talking about the first known statues, a woman, the famed Venus of Willendorf. What was that, Gene? 25,000 years old.
Yeah, and it's really this little plump little statuette.
It's like 3 inches, 4 inches tall.
Yeah.
I call her the Pillsbury Doughgirl.
Yes. It's because all of her life-giving features, breasts and butt or so on, are fat. They're exaggerated.
It's just really the very most essential fertility symbol.
Living at the mercy of nature, these people probably worshipped Mother Nature.
Well, fast forward about 20,000 years, and what do we find?
Now, they've lost a lot of weight in that time. Must have been the paleo diet. These figurines are skinny. They're just like little supermodels.
So these are the Cycladic figurines from the islands, the Greek islands that we visit.
Yes. And no one knows what these were about. Were these fertility figures? Or were they used in funerals? Were they good luck charms? Or were they just prehistoric Barbie girls, just dolls? No one knows.
Okay, and then during the classical golden age of Greece, you've got the sort of the iconic Venus de Milo, Winged Victory.
The classic Venuses. On the one hand, they portrayed realistic women. The Greeks were great at that. But on the other hand, they had idealized faces and perfectly balanced proportions. For the Greeks, it seemed to capture the perfect geometrical order that they saw in the cosmos.
So kind of a sort of a religious thing. And then when the Christian era comes, these Venuses morph into Marys.
They become Marys. Venus, the earthly goddess of love, suddenly becomes Mary, the symbol of divine love.
And you see these Marys, these Madonnas everywhere. In fact, so many churches are even called Notre Dame.
Our Lady.
That's right. Yeah. So then the theme of women, it carries on through the Renaissance.
You got, you know, Botticelli, who did his Venuses. You got Mona Lisa by Leonardo da Vinci. Not only were these women and Venuses, but again, they captured this perfect balance and harmony that they saw in God's creation.
And even in the modern era, we see Picasso has this fixation, really, on Venuses and women.
Venuses and women. His Guernica has a Mary and a child in it, a modern type of Pietà, almost.
Gene, it seems that images of women have been created since the beginning of time to celebrate their power, their beauty, and their symbolism.
Yeah, I think of France, whose national symbol is a woman, a kind of every woman known as Marianne. She symbolizes the French courage and the ongoing fight for freedom.
You know, you see a Marianne on the facade of almost every city hall. You see her on the Arc de Triomphe right there in the middle of Paris. Images like these really pack a punch, whether as fierce revolutionaries or as gentle Madonnas.
Or as goddesses, or nymphs, or factory workers.
It's clear that the women of art have always represented our greatest and most valued ideals. Gene, it's been fun riffing on culture with you. It's a good reminder that a little art and history can add a whole new dimension to your travels. Thanks a lot.
Always a pleasure.
You can also hear Gene and me discuss visiting Madrid's massive Prado Art Museum on our Spain-themed program number 595. You'll find it in our Travel with Rick Steves archives from February 2020. It's at ricksteves.com/radio.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington by Tim Patton, Isaac Kaplan-Wilner, and Kazmara Hall. Our website is managed by Andrew Wakeling and Amara Kipnikon. We get promotional support from Sheila Gruzoff. Our theme music is by Jerry Frank. You'll find more at ricksteves.com/radio.